It is not worth it to cheat in a federal election. That is a crime, my friends, you do not want to commit. We need to ensure that people understand the severity of this and they are not even tempted.
Good advice. Maybe you should have mentioned that to your father-in-law, Laura Trump.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe for you every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. The criminal trial in New York against Donald J. Trump, the first of four that he is scheduled to face in four different jurisdictions, is on break today, Desi Doyen.
I know, giving everybody a chance to catch their breath.
Well, to catch their breath and to catch up and sort of get our bearings on what has happened there this week.
Yep.
And what to expect in the days ahead. We'll be joined by two guests momentarily to discuss that. But first, it was primary day for voters on Tuesday in the great state of Pennsylvania. And though the two leading candidates in the presidential race in each party have already won the requisite number of delegates to needed to win their party's nomination at the at their national conventions this summer, the reported results of voting in Pennsylvania in each of the two presidential primary contests on Tuesday was still somewhat enlightening, it seems to me, in this critical presidential battleground state. Now, as expected, of course, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump won their party's primaries on Tuesday easily, though President Biden picked up more than 93% of the vote from Democrats, while Donald Trump won just over 83% among Republicans. Former South Carolina governor and Trump's own UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, who suspended her campaign months ago, she still picked up almost 17% of the Republican votes that were cast in Tuesday's election.
Wow.
17%. She received about 20% or higher in some areas around Philadelphia.
Oh, man. So people came out to vote against Trump.
They did. And that seems like a lot of Republicans saying that we want someone else as our party's nominee this late in the game. And keep in mind here, by the way, Pennsylvania has closed primaries. So unlike in states where, you know, those registered as Democrats or independents can choose to vote in the Republican primary to try to cause trouble, to support Nikki Haley, make Donald Trump look bad. In this case, in Pennsylvania, only registered Republicans were allowed to vote in the Republican race on Tuesday. And for that matter, only Democrats could vote on the Democratic side. So, you know, that was not Democrats crossing over to vote for Nikki Haley to stir up trouble for the presumptive GOP candidate Donald Trump. It seems there's really a pretty substantial part of his party, still pushing almost 20% of his own Republican Party that does not want to vote for Donald Trump.
And they took time out of their day to say so.
By contrast to Haley's nearly 17% on the Republican side against Trump, over on the Democratic side, Minnesota's U.S. Congressman Dean Phillips won just under 7% against Joe Biden in a party said to be torn by the Biden administration's support for Israel amid its ongoing brutal war in Gaza. So if the vote for Phillips was a protest vote, it was still well less than half the size of the protest vote by Republicans against Donald Trump. And again, this is in Pennsylvania. An important, a critical state in presidential elections, where Trump won by about 44,000 votes in 2016 out of, I think, some 6 million cast. So he narrowly won there. Biden narrowly won it in 2020 by just about 83,000 votes. In that state, turnout by Democrats on Tuesday, even for an incumbent president running for re-election with no real competition to speak of, outpaced Republican turnout by more than 50,000 votes.
Hmm.
Not entirely sure what to take from that, but it seems worth noting today. In Pennsylvania, at least, about 130,000 more voters voted for Joe Biden on Tuesday than they did for Donald Trump. Make of that what you will. In other contests of national note on the ballot in the Keystone State on Tuesday for Congress, 44 candidates were on the ballots in Pennsylvania Tuesday, including all 17 of the state's incumbent members of Congress, most of whom did not face primary challengers on Tuesday. All three incumbents who did face primary challengers, however, Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick in suburban Philadelphia and Democratic Reps Dwight Evans in Philadelphia and Summer Lee in a Pittsburgh-based district. All of those incumbents won their races on Tuesday. The progressive Summer Lee's primary against the centrist Democratic challenger Bhavini Patel was seen as an early test of whether Israel's war with Gaza, which Lee has been outspoken in opposing, if that poses political threats to progressive Democrats in Congress who have criticized how that war has been handled. In Pittsburgh, at least, on Tuesday, Summer Lee's party's voters stuck with her. She reportedly defeated Patel by about 22 points of airtime today, 61-39%. Other than president, perhaps the biggest race on the state's ballot in November will be the U.S. Senate race there, as Democrats have to defend a lot of seats across the country this year with their current two-vote majority in the upper house seriously threatened, and with Pennsylvania's Democratic Senator Bob Casey up for re-election. Casey will face Republican challenger David McCormick in November, in a high-stakes race expected to cost hundreds of millions of dollars to help decide control of the Senate next year. Casey and McCormick each won their respective party primary contests on Tuesday, but that was easy because both of them ran uncontested. Casey is seeking his fourth term. He is perhaps Pennsylvania's best-known politician. He's a stalwart of the presidential swing state's Democratic Party. He's the son of a former two-term governor and Pennsylvania's longest ever serving Democrat in the Senate. McCormick, meanwhile, is a two-time Senate challenger, or loser, depending on how you want to look at it. He's a former hedge fund CEO. He's a Pennsylvania native who spent some $14 million of his own money, must be nice, in the state's 2022 GOP Senate primary, only to lose to TV celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz in a seven-way GOP primary. Oz then went on to lose to the state's then Democratic Lieutenant Governor, now U.S. Senator John Fetterman, in a pivotal Senate contest that year. This time around, McCormick has apparently consolidated the party around his candidacy to the point that no one else wanted to run against him. He's backed by a super PAC that has already reported raising more than $20 million, much of it from securities trading billionaires, underscoring once again that their taxes are way too low. If they've got so many millions to just donate to candidates who were actually two-time losers.
Yeah, but they really do. These rich guys really do want their tax cuts, and they're going to spend what they can to get the to take over the Senate and get those tax cuts.
And get those tax cuts if Donald Trump is back in office,
right?
Because the tax cuts that he did when he was in the office last time will be
set to expire,
and they want to renew them. By the way, it cost the U.S. trillions of dollars in lost revenue. Where did that revenue go? It went to the pockets of these securities trading billionaires so they could give it to their preferred Senate candidate in Pennsylvania so they could get some more of that free money. McCormick's candidacy is shaping up as the strongest challenge, however, to Casey in his three reelection bids so far. Though an investigative report by the New York Times last week likely may not be very helpful to McCormick. I don't have the time to get into the details today with two guests standing by to join us momentarily. I hope to do so in the not too distant future, however. But for now, suffice to say, McCormick claims that he grew up on a family farm in Pennsylvania, while the New York Times reporting suggests he has given, let's say for now, a misleading impression about key aspects of his background. We will see if we can get to that another day. And more importantly, we'll see what Pennsylvania voters think of his less than accurately portrayed life story in his third attempt to reach the U.S. Senate. And in a couple of noteworthy headlines today on Tuesday night, the U.S. Senate passed long overdue, long delayed military and humanitarian assistance to war-torn Ukraine after the GOP-controlled House finally approved a measure for some $61 billion in assistance, thanks to the GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson and his sudden, still not fully explained about face on the issue last week, and the entire Democratic caucus who joined him to support passage of the measure in order to overcome GOP opposition for support of our Democratic allies in Europe, who are now in the third year of their defensive war against Russia's brutal, imperialist, unlawful 2022 invasion. On Wednesday morning, President Biden quickly signed the measure following Senate passage the night before and offered these comments when he did.
We're all standing together against this brutal dictator. As I've argued for months, this is directly in the United States' national security interest. If Putin triumphs in Ukraine, the next move of Russian forces could very well be a direct attack on a NATO ally. If Putin attacks a NATO ally like he's attacking Ukraine today, we'd have no choice but to come to their aid, just like our NATO allies came to our aid after the September 11th attacks here. America stands with our friends. We stand up against dictators. We bow to no one, certainly not Vladimir Putin.
That was the president in the White House on Wednesday after signing the bill. It's actually a bipartisan $95 billion package, which saw overwhelming support in the Senate on Tuesday after only a minority of Republicans were willing to vote for it in favor of it in the House. That measure also includes money to replace Israel's defensive missile system following last week's attack by Iran, billions of dollars in humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza, and for military support for Taiwan. Also, the measure ridiculously includes a provision supported by both Democrats and Republicans alike, again, ridiculously, in my opinion, that could end up banning the popular social media app TikTok in the U.S. if its Beijing parent company does not sell the app to a different company a non-Chinese company, I guess, over the next year.
I just want to point out that Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, said she did not want that provision in there, but she had to go ahead and vote for it in order to get Ukraine aid out the door.
On Wednesday morning, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a challenge to the Biden administration, who, after the Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade, made clear that a federal law known as EMTALA, which stands for the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, requires hospitals in all states, no matter their current laws on abortion, requires hospitals that receive federal money to provide life-stabilizing treatment to patients who need it, despite whether they have insurance or not, to prevent so-called patient dumping. But after Dobbs was overturned, the Biden administration made clear that those hospitals must also provide emergency abortion care if needed to save a patient's life, no matter what the state laws are regarding abortion. As in Idaho, which is the state that is suing the administration to make sure that federally funded hospitals don't have to offer abortions in such cases, even when it means stabilizing a patient to prevent her from dying. You will be shocked to learn that the corrupted high court was sharply divided on the matter on Wednesday, with questions from the court's far, far right suggesting that they plan to prevent federal law from taking precedent over state law in such cases. And one more before we get to the stormy weather at Donald Trump's New York criminal trial this week. In not unrelated news to the Supreme Court's hearing on Wednesday morning, in Arizona on Wednesday afternoon, Democrats in the Republican-controlled Arizona State House were finally successful after 3 weeks of trying to vote to overturn, to repeal the state's draconian 1864 territorial ban on almost all abortions. Three Republicans joined in with all 29 Democrats on Wednesday to repeal the 160-year-old law that predated Arizona's statehood and provides no exception for rape or incest. If the Senate now, the state Senate, approves, the state Senate is also controlled by Republicans who have over 3 weeks prevented the repeal from coming up even for a vote. But if the Senate approves, Arizona would then fall back on its already existing 15-week abortion ban. All right, that's it for the moment. Let's take a quick break here. We'll be joined by Keith Barber and Heather Digby Parton to get caught up on all the fun happening in a New York criminal courtroom this week, where Donald J. Trump faces 34 criminal felony charges, and we're only now beginning to see how much trouble this guy might be in for paying off a porn star to help him cheat to win the 2016 presidential election. That's straight ahead today. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Can't hold his head up high. Stormy Daniels, she went through all the legal channels. Keeps talking all the time.
Yeah, she does, and I like it. That, by the way, I'm happy to say, is the dulcet tones of Bethany Barber, the daughter of one of our expert guests joining us today momentarily. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, after a week of jury selection last week, which appears to have gone much faster than most observers had expected, in the first ever criminal trial of a former and perhaps future U.S. president. The New York trial against Donald J. Trump on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in order to hide hush money payments made to a porn star just before the 2016 presidential election, in order to cheat in that election. That trial saw opening statements from both sides this week, the first witness for the prosecution, and a contempt hearing against the defendant for at least 10 instances of violating the gag order imposed on him by the judge to prevent him from attacking witnesses, jurors, or family members of the court or state prosecutors. The week began with a few fits and starts thanks to that contempt hearing and shortened court days on Monday and Tuesday due to the Passover holiday, and the court will be taking Wednesdays off for the duration of the trial, which is expected to last about 6 weeks. But a lot has already happened in the two shortened days that kicked off the trial proper on Monday, including fascinating testimony from the former publisher of the National Enquirer and longtime pal of Trump, a guy by the name of David Pecker, who was called to testify about a key part of what prosecutors describe as a criminal conspiracy to use hush money and so-called catch-and-kill schemes, buying up embarrassing stories to subsequently not publish them in order to bury them from the public, all in hopes of improving Trump's chances of winning the 2016 presidential election. The conspiracy, which state prosecutors sharply characterized as, quote, election fraud, pure and simple, during opening statements, including plotting between Trump and Pecker and Trump's then fixer and personal attorney Michael Cohen. He paid some $130,000 to the adult film star Stormy Daniels in the weeks just prior to the 2016 election to keep her quiet about the sexual tryst that she says she had with Trump years earlier while his wife Melania was nursing their newborn son. Subsequently, Trump reimbursed Michael Cohen, according to prosecutors, some $420,000 while he was serving in the White House. Yes, the president was signing monthly checks to Michael Cohen to cover the payment to Stormy Daniels, some other money that was owed to Cohen for his work on the 2016 campaign, and a $60,000 bonus, all of which was then doubled in order to cover the taxes that Cohen would have to pay for that income. While Trump's attorneys claim those payments were simply a normal legal retainer agreement, payments to Cohen, which had never been structured that way with Trump in all of the years that Cohen had been working for him, prosecutors said during opening arguments, they have handwritten notes from the Trump Organization chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, breaking down the true reason for those payments to Cohen. It is those payments, a number of checks and records of them in the company's logs, all characterized by Trump and the company as legal fees, which New York prosecutors allege are 34 instances of falsified business records. In his first two shortened days on the stand, Pecker, who in 2018 agreed to cooperate with prosecutors looking into this same matter, which ultimately resulted in Cohen's guilty plea and a year in jail at the federal level for a conspiracy that he and federal prosecutors said at the time was, quote, directed by Donald Trump. Pecker, in those first 2 days, testified to how the Enquirer would pay Trump for stories, pay him money for stories during his hit TV show The Apprentice, and how he, Cohen, and Trump met in 2015 to discuss ways that Pecker's grocery store tabloid could help Trump win as he decided to run for president. That included a relentless series of stories, week after week, attacking Trump's political opponents, including Republicans Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz during the primary, and then Democrat Hillary Clinton in the months leading up to the general election. In addition to running stories meant to help Trump, Pecker also agreed to catch and kill stories that might hurt him, like the former Trump doorman who claimed that Trump had an out-of-wedlock son with a maid at Trump Tower. That guy received $30,000 to shut up about it. And there was Karen McDougal, the Playboy model, who says she had a nearly year-long affair with Trump while his wife Melania was pregnant. She received $150,000 from the Inquirer for her story, which they never ran. And though this is the cliffhanger we were all left with at the end of the court day on Tuesday during Pecker's testimony, the affair with Stormy Daniels, who Cohn took out a second mortgage on his home to pay personally to shut her up before being paid back after Trump won the 2016 election. Prosecutors are expected to dig into testimony from Pecker on what happened in the Stormy Daniels matter and why his company, Pecker's company, the AMI, which owned National Enquirer, decided not to pay her off, requiring Cohen to do so. That's supposed to pick up when the trial reconvenes on Thursday. Joining us now for thoughts and insights on our story so far as the trial gets up to speed in its first week of testimony are two regular guests on this program who joined us last week as the jury selection got underway. Our old friend Heather Digby Parton is, of course, the much beloved blogger and award-winning columnist at Salon and at her own Hullabaloo blog, where she is simply known as Digby. Hey, Digby.
Hey.
And Keith Barber, whose daughter Bethany has the beautiful voice that helped us kick off this segment. He is a former attorney, former lifelong Republican, and frequent contributor to Daily Kos, where he writes as simply Keith DB on legal and constitutional matters. Welcome back, Keith Barber.
Thanks, Brad. Where'd you get that incredible voice from?
Yeah, well, you know, that's it. She sounds great. And she may end up, I think, being a frequent contributor to this show herself, whether she knows it or not. Keith, let me start.
I just want you to know I paid for that voice.
I guess you did. Let me start with you, Keith, as an attorney here. Though the ruling by Justice Juan Merchan has not yet been issued, it could happen at any time, even during our conversation today on the contempt hearing. What do we need to know about that hearing that took place on Tuesday morning regarding more than 10 instances of Trump violating the gag order, culminating, by the way, in the judge telling Trump's attorney, Todd Blanche, you're losing all credibility with the court? That doesn't sound like a good place for a defense attorney to be on day two of a trial.
You know, in a list of phrases that could be the worst that come out of a judge's mouth in the first 2 days of a trial, I guess that would be right at the top of the list. It is hard to imagine things getting off to a worse foot. And, you know, at least the jury was out of the room when that was said. But it's designed to send a message to Trump's lawyers now that you've got to pull your client in and you've got to find a way to do it. Was the point of that.
Well, is there any chance that they actually will? Again, we don't have the ruling yet. Prosecutors have asked only for $1,000 fine for each violation. I mean, this guy is paying about $150,000 a day over the past year for legal fees. Even if he's found guilty of all 10, I think they added a few more on Tuesday, found guilty of all 10 instances for $10,000, big whoop. Isn't that worth the price?
Yeah, it's Trump change for him.
There you go.
and no, that's not going to deter him. I think that Trump would willingly accept that. Now, it's a little bit of bad PR for him, but then again, not too much. You know, the jury is probably going to hear about it one way or another, even mm-hmm. though they shouldn't, and that's not good for him. But there have been other things that have happened in this that I think will at least encourage Trump's attorneys to try and rein him in. And, you know, the big one that really comes to mind is his attorney said to the prosecutors, hey, you need to extend us the common courtesy, traditional courtesy, of telling us who, you know, your schedule of witnesses, mm-hmm. in essence, who you're going to put up first. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutor said, no, we're not going to do that because we're afraid that telling you that will just put a bullseye on them for your client to attack.
Yeah.
And the attorneys tried to say, well, no, you know, we'll get Trump to not do that. And the prosecutor said, you know what? We don't think you can make that representation. And the judge took the prosecutor's side on that.
Yeah.
It is, you know, just kind of a customary courtesy. And the judge said, I'm not going to make them do it because their concern is legitimate.
And I don't know what's going to, I mean, prosecutors did not ask, they specifically, I guess, did not ask for jail time. The judge could apply it here anyway. Heather Digby Parton, in your opinion, what will it take to prevent Trump from violating this gag order as you see it? I mean, as Keith says, $10,000 is Trump change at this point.
Well, it's certainly not going to be money. I mean, the guy owes, you know, almost $500 million in another case and mm-hmm. was, you know, also owes another $100 billion in the E. Jean Carroll case. So, you know, money is not really the issue here because, you know, he just isn't motivated by that in terms of these, especially these small amounts. But I don't, you know, it's going to be very difficult to see how they could actually incarcerate him. You know, I read that the Secret Service is putting together plans in just in case they, you know, the judge decides to throw the book at him and put him, you know, in jail for, I don't know, some kind of brief period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I assume it would be for a, you know, a day or two or something like that. I just don't know. I don't know what they can do to shut him up. I mean, they had that hearing yesterday morning. And, you know, all this stuff was being said and, you know, they were all, you know, discussing it. The judge is going to come out with a ruling any minute now. And Trump went out on and went on TV last
yeah.
night and did it again. I mean, he went after Michael Cohen. I just don't think there's any way to stop him. So I don't know really what can be done here. Because
would incarcerating him stop him if they did figure out a way to do it? No.
It's the opposite. He'll end up, you know, I mean, his entire strategy here, you know, legally, it appears legally and politically, is to portray himself as a victim, as a martyr in this. I mean, they're out there calling him Nelson Mandela for crying out loud. You
right.
know, they're calling him Jesus Christ. I mean, so putting him in jail is exactly the kind of thing that he thinks will, you know, will help him. And I don't think it will stop him. I mean, they have talked about it. Maybe Keith can address this better than I, about, you know, sequestering the jury, you know, which is really kind of an extreme way of dealing with this in terms of, you know, his threats to the jurors and maybe putting a gag order on Michael Cohen, which probably should happen because he really should shut
well,
up.
Well, Keith, let me get your thoughts on that because, I, you know, sequestering the jury might make sense. And I think we might have even talked about it a little bit last week, but that doesn't prevent Trump from attacking witnesses and intimidating witnesses when they're on the stand or before they come on to the stand. I mean, do you see any way to actually end this, Keith?
No. I think sequestering its the jury creates, you know, another cluster of problems. Amongst other things, you have 18 people who kind of disappear, if you will, from their friends and family and so forth because they're sequestered. And so you expand the opportunities for these people to be identified,
mm-hmm.
I guess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's a tough trade-off. The defense would almost certainly oppose it. Now, that's kind of an interesting aspect of this because the traditional line of thinking on this is that, you know, being sequestered just makes jurors all that more angry and resentful at the defendant.
Mm.
So they would likely oppose it. And as Heather rightly suggests, it really only deals with half the problem. Much of what Trump is doing is an effort to intimidate witnesses and not just the jurors. And, you know, bad-mouthing Michael Cohen,
mm-hmm.
There seems to be nothing that will stop him from doing that.
And by the way, should there be anything to stop him? I mean, Michael Cohen is out there bad-mouthing Trump, so shouldn't Trump get to respond in kind?
I agree with Heather that the judge should order Cohen to shut up, too.
There you go.
But,
well,
you know, these things often only apply against parties to a case and not the witnesses. Trump's the defendant. he's the one that can intimidate. Cullen can't.
Let's move on here, since our time is short, to the, well, to the trial itself, if we can get out of gag order contempt hearing land for a minute. Heather, let's sort of start broadly. How's the trial going for Donald Trump? It's as it gets finally underway. He told us, after all, that these indictments, you know, he's facing four of them total, criminal indictments in four different jurisdictions, that they were working to his benefit. So is this one working out well for him at this early date on a, I guess, a political level?
I don't think so. It doesn't appear so. In fact, I saw some polling yesterday that showed that since this, you know, this case has become more, available to the public in the media, that, mm-hmm. that his polling has actually suffered. It's also clear that he's not drawing the crowds that he wants. And he put out a real call for people to come, and they didn't on Tuesday. He put out a fundraising letter that was asking for that. And of course, he's hinting around about that on Truth Social as well. So,
he's more than hinting around. Let me just read what he said, because after this lack of pro-Trump protesters outside the courthouse began, he took to social media. He said, unlike at Columbia University, where the radical left Palestinian protesters sat at the front lawn, practically took over the school and screamed death to the Jews, death to Israel, death to America, and nothing happened to them, Lower Manhattan surrounding the courthouse where I am heading now is completely closed down. Trump, that's what he said on Truth Social. So unfair. Republicans want the right to protest in front of the courthouse like everyone. Your response?
Well, it's a lie, for one thing. You know, all the reporters are there. They're going, no, it's actually not closed down. People are walking by. You know, there is a designated protest area. And, like, you know, a handful of people, at most four or five a day, are showing up. And uh-huh. half of them, you know, they're kooks. And then Trump went on. He lied again in a much more extreme fashion, saying there were thousands of people at the door going into the courthouse who were turned away. And all the reporters go, what's he talking about? There's nobody there. It's like, we're there. It's the same door we go into. What's he talking about? But of course, you know, he knows that his people, you know, he has totally indoctrinated them to believe only the facts that he gives them. And, you know, that if anybody says anything to the contrary, it's fake news, which is really ironic, since this trial so far for the first 2 days is all about Trump and his good pal, David Pecker, who, by the way, Keith and I both said was going to be a star witness. Mm-hmm. I'd like to pat us both on the back for that. Okay. Said, you know, that their little scheme back in 2015 and 2016 was all fake news.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, literally. The irony of ironies. No, literally fake news. Yeah. They made up stories, and we knew that they did. And they killed, you know, Pecker, you know, he testified to all of this, that they killed negative stories about Trump, and they pushed negative stories that, by the way, were literally fake news about his rival.
Yeah.
And this was their entire scheme, was based upon fake news.
That's the business model.
So for him to be out there saying, yeah, it's the business model. For him to be out there saying that, you know, it's all fake, that, you know, really there are thousands of people clamoring to get, you know, to protest, and they're not being allowed to, even though there are pictures proving otherwise. I mean, I guess this is just, it's like gaslighting to the thousandth power.
Well,
and you're supposed to just sit there and go, okay, you know, whatever you say, dude.
Yeah, and you know what I think is also interesting is that Trump has apparently also trained the big corporate media outlets to really not focus on the fact that he was lying through his teeth about all of that, because there's so much else that they also have to cover that's also bonkers about this whole thing.
Well, let me just note that I think the big question here, in one sense, is, why aren't his protesters showing up, whether it's at his, you know, his various indictments, now at his trials, court cases? Why are they not showing up? I mean, he, you know, back before January 6, 2021, he put out a note saying, hey, come to the Capitol. It will be wild. Now he's, you know, yelling and screaming, begging people to show up and support him. They ain't coming. Either you got an explanation for that?
You know, I think that his attractiveness is overrated. We were talking just a bit before the show about Pennsylvania and the fact that in that state, 15% of the people in a closed primary voted against him from his own party against a candidate who wasn't even running. You know, that was just pure Republican protest vote there. And if that happens come the election, things are going to be awfully difficult for him.
And note that far fewer people voted in the Republican primary at all than voted in the Democratic primary. And both of them, you know, they have the presumptive nominees. There's no real, you know, motivation necessarily to go out and vote. But but they, you know, way more Democrats voted than Republicans. And the only, they had a tiny group that, you know, voted for Dean Phillips as a protest vote or whatever, many fewer than did that in the Republicans.
You know, I will say, I'll just throw in my own thoughts on this, on why he's not getting the crowds at the courthouses and so forth that he wants. You know, I've been doing this, and Heather, I know you have as well, for years and years, blogging, writing. People are excited. They will, for example, donate money in the days leading up to an election when they, you know, they think that everything counts on what is about to happen on this election. When he called them on January 6th to the Capitol, they thought they were there to actually overturn, save the election, to steal it back from Joe Biden, who they felt stole it from them. That was all on the line. They weren't there, I don't think, for Donald Trump. I don't know that it's, you know, that they idol worship him. Maybe they do. But when it comes to, you know, putting shoes on the ground and showing up to fight, they will fight if they think an election is at stake. But if it's Donald Trump's payoff to a porn star, I'm not sure they're all that interested. Anyway, that's kind of my theory. You know, you're on your own, Mr. Trump. We're not going to jail for that. Let's talk about the trial itself, the case itself. Keith, in their opening statement, prosecutors characterized all of this as election fraud, pure and simple, though that's not actually what Trump is charged with. He's charged with falsifying records, business records. Why are they focusing on the conspiracy aspect of this and the election fraud aspect in their case?
They need to show, you know, fundamental aspect of their case, particularly for the felony amplification that they're looking for here, is that Cohen's payment to Stormy Daniels was a campaign contribution. And then they had to cover up that it was a campaign contribution with the false business records. But and that's what makes it a felony amplification. But you've got to get to that first part, that this was to save the campaign.
So let me clarify that. So when you say the felony amplification, in fact, these 34 charges falsifying business records, they're actually misdemeanors in New York law, unless they were done to hide or cover up another crime. That bumps it up to felonies. Do I understand that correctly? That's how we get to 34 felonies?
That is dead on correct. And in this case, that other crime is the campaign financing law violation.
Now, do they have to prove both in their case, the falsifying of business records and the campaign finance conspiracy and so forth? Do they have to prove both of those crimes beyond a reasonable doubt for a conviction here? Or could the jury just decide, well, yeah, he's guilty, but of a misdemeanor falsification, not felony falsification of records?
Well, yeah, the jury could decide that it's just a misdemeanor falsification. They could decide that it wasn't proven beyond reasonable doubt, that it was done to conceal, because that's an essential element of the amplification. That it wasn't done to conceal another crime, but it was done.
So he could still be guilty of that as a misdemeanor, not a felony?
Yes, yes. And so, you know, Trump would claim it's a vindication.
Right.
Being, you know, convicted of 34 misdemeanors for fraud, he would claim would be a complete vindication. And a lot of his followers would accept it as that.
Heather, you wrote this week at Salon, I believe it was before Pecker's testimony began, you said, quote, Pecker was given immunity by federal prosecutors in the Michael Cohen case back in 2018. He went to jail for all of this and testified that Trump was involved up to his neck. And yet, while Trump has crudely insulted everyone involved in this case, including Michael Cohen, of course, and in his current case, he has never said a word against Pecker. You said that's curious. It is curious. Why do you think that is?
Golly, I can't imagine why he would not say anything against the guy who used to have a safe in his office that held piles of incriminating information on people. One of the things that you see in this, as this is unfolding, is the fact that he and Pecker had a longstanding relationship. They were friends. Pecker traveled on the airplane and all that stuff. And yet, you know, Pecker, interestingly enough, I mean, and I still don't think we have an adequate explanation for how and why this happened. We know this now. He was in this plot from the very beginning. I mean, Trump called him into the office and said, "What can you do to help my campaign?" Mm-hmm. Which I think, by the way, just responding to something that Keith said, I think that's part of what the prosecutors are trying to prove about the felony. They were saying they're going to show that he concealed this information and that he was trying to cover up. And what he was covering up was campaign violations. And Pecker's testimony to that effect and the way that they did all this conspiracy with Cohen and him, it was all about the campaign. You know, Trump's going to say, "I just didn't want Melania to find out." You know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you know, this is a guy who went on, you know, I mean, he had a long, long history of this. Melania knew what she had married. Let's just put it that way. And so, you know, I think that the fact is that Pecker was sitting there in on this thing from the very beginning and had been working with him. And then suddenly the feds come along and they raided Michael Cohen's office and got this, all these documents and various, you know, forms of information and evidence. Mm-hmm. And Pecker just turned on a dime against Trump. I mean, it was abrupt, apparently. I mean, he'd been going to the White House, he had all this stuff, and then all of a sudden, boom, he said. Now, you know, Pecker may just be a guy who was looking at self-preservation and said, you know, "Look, I'm in this up to my neck, and right. I don't want to go to jail, and I'm not going to do it." And that's the simplest explanation.
So, but your theory, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, Trump had pardon power at the time, right? I mean, this is 2017 or 2018 when this happened. Mm-hmm. Trump had pardon power. Everybody else sort of went, well, you know, I'll string along. Even Michael Cohen strung it along for quite a while until Trump stopped paying his legal bills.
But now he's not attacking Pecker. Is your theory then that despite all that we know and all that Pecker will testify to here, that Pecker's got a whole bunch of other stuff that ain't going to come out, that he doesn't want to come out? That's
That is exactly what I'm implying.
can I jump in here, Brad?
Yeah, go ahead.
6 years ago, 2018, I wrote an article entitled, "Is the National Enquirer an Extortion Racket?" And it was about a safe that David Pecker had that had all sorts of stuff on a whole lot of people, to include Donald Trump. And it was shortly after that he flipped. Uh-huh. There's reason to believe that David Pecker has more of Trump's bodies buried in various places and has told various officials about it.
That's above and beyond.
And listen, he sure didn't seem intimidated. Let's put it that way. From the reports that we got of his testimony and the fact that, I mean, he's testified before grand juries in the federal case, in Michael Cohen's federal case, and in the Manhattan DA case that he's testifying in now. He's been doing this all the way along. And granted, he's not out there saying anything and showboating to the public. But who cares? I mean, this is where it counts. And this guy is not intimidated by Donald Trump. He's sitting there right in front of him. He knows him very well, and he's looking right at him. And he could be the next president of the United States again. And he just he's laying it all out there, as far as we can tell.
Yeah.
You have to wonder, why is this? I mean, I wonder, and I think that Keith is right. You know, this is about, he has information. Donald Trump knows he has information, and he's being very, very quiet about it. Kind of the way he is with Vladimir Putin. Very similar kind of dynamic that we're
interesting.
Seeing.
In other words, he can be quiet when he wants to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because he has. Exactly. He has gone against everyone else. And particularly Pecker is up on the stand, I mean, saying one thing after another that has just got to be brutal for Trump to sit and listen to, but you don't see him going
not
out and attacking Pecker. Very interesting. Keith, you and I spoke.
One of the first things that Pecker testified to in response to a question from the prosecution, or why are you testifying here today, was, well, I'm here because I have to be, because you guys sent me a subpoena.
Yep.
That was arranged. I'm telling you, that was arranged between him and the prosecution as a way of getting it out there early that he wasn't really trying to cooperate with the prosecution.
Uh-huh.
He was just there because they made him.
He had no choice. Keith,
yeah.
you and I, we spoke a little bit offline, I think, over the weekend before the testimony began. This doorman, Dino Sejudin, he's the doorman who tried to sell what they claim is a fabricated story about Trump fathering a child with a maid out of wedlock. They eventually came to determine that the story was not true, according to Pecker and Cohen, though it's unclear to me how they determined that. But we'll put that aside for the moment. Isn't that a way out for Trump if that story is untrue? Trump insists that he had never had affairs with McDougal or Stormy Daniels. So if they were willing to pay Dino the doorman $30,000 to shut up about a story that they knew was untrue, isn't that a good defense for Trump that, yeah, that's right. And we also paid McDougal and Daniels. We knew their stories were false as well. Even though, you know, Mitt Romney said the other day, oh, you don't pay $130,000 for someone you didn't have sex with. Well, can't they point to the doorman and say, yeah, we didn't want stories that would hurt us, whether they were true or false. Dino was false, so were the girls.
Yeah, well, they did pay McDougal and Daniels four and five times as much as they paid that doorman.
Yeah.
And I don't know. As near as I can tell, Pecker just came to his own conclusion that he didn't think that the doorman's story was credible. I'm not sure what that reason was. It probably had to do with not being able to identify the supposed housekeeper who had the baby and stuff like that. But whatever the reasons, Pecker also testified kind of interestingly that if he had determined that the doorman's story was true,
mm-hmm.
that he would have eventually have released it, but not until after the election.
That he would have published the story.
campaign violation there, right? I mean,
I think the defense is going to lean in hard on that when it comes to why they made these payments, because we just didn't want any bad press. So even if a guy was lying like Dino, we paid him. Even if the girls were lying, we paid them. Yes, we had to pay them more because they felt that it was a more damaging story. Do we yet know why? And I got to get out here shortly, guys. But do we yet know why Pecker and his company, AMI, was willing to pay both Dino the doorman and Karen McDougal, but not Stormy Daniels, that Michael Cohen had to take out a second mortgage to pay? Why?
Well, there are two reasons. The first is that Trump, the tightwad, didn't pay AMI back for the McDougal thing. They made them eat that fee, that hush money payment. That's part of it. But the other part of it, which I think is very interesting, and we'll see if it comes out, but there is some evidence that Pecker started to get the idea that this might be illegal, having to do with campaign finance. And supposedly there are a number of reports, and the one that I'm referring specifically is a very, very good series of reports that came out in the Wall Street Journal, who really broke this story, weirdly enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that Pecker consulted an attorney after the Karen McDougal payment. And the attorney said, you're playing with fire here. This is a presidential campaign. You do not want to be paying this money out. Mm. And at that point, that is when he said, no, I'm not covering this. Mm. I'm not going to pay this. You guys have to figure it out. You know, we'll do the dirty work here of keeping it, off the, out of the press.
And
they would work on the NDAs and do all that stuff, but they were not going to pay that money out. And so if that's the case and it comes out in testimony, Pecker will be saying clearly that he knew that this was a campaign finance violation to be paying this money. And then the question will be, did he tell Trump, Cohen know that? I mean, how much did they all know? And by the way, from what I understand, maybe Keith can clear this up. On a conspiracy case, which is what the prosecutors are saying was a conspiracy, it wouldn't even really matter how much each individual knows about the conspiracy, only the fact that they're in the conspiracy together to be held liable for a violation. So it will be very interesting to see how this comes out. But from what I understand, Pecker knew that this was a problem, and that's why he didn't pay the Stormy Daniels money.
And I got to go.
And also, Trump is cheap.
Did he ever pay Pecker back for Dina the Doorman and Karen McDougal? As far as we know,
no idea.
No,
he didn't. Okay.
My understanding, he did not.
I suspect we'll hear much more testimony about all of this in the days ahead, and we will be speaking to you guys more about all of this in the days ahead. By the way, Josh Kovensky over at Talking Points Memo notes that that this week during Pecker's testimony that we have been treated to some discussion of one way in which Michael Cohen denied the veracity of the allegation from Dino the Doorman, which is that the maid in question was Hispanic, and therefore it was, quote, impossible for the story to be true.
Oh. My goodness.
He adds,
okay.
He adds make of that what you will.
That's the Eugene Carroll, not my type defense.
Yeah, exactly. All right. You guys are always my type. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be talking to you soon. Heather Digby Parton, find her work. Read it every day at salon.com and digbysblog.net. And please follow her on the Twitters, if you will, at digby56. You can find Keith Barber over at dailycoast.com, where he writes as Keith DB. And you can find him on the Twitters at KeithDB80. Thanks, guys. We'll be talking soon.
Thanks.
Thanks, Brad. Have a good one.
You too. Okay, we got to get out. By the way, quick tease for tomorrow's broadcast. The Supreme Court is hearing Donald Trump's ridiculous presidential immunity case.
Yep.
On the very last day that they possibly could, the last oral argument of the year, they've been put this as could have been decided last December.
But no.
Trump's case for trying to steal the federal case for trying to steal the 2020 election could have already been done by this point.
But they're helping him delay.
Ain't they, though? Anyway, coverage of that on our next thrilling broadcast. Until then, thanks again to Digby and Keith and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible only by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. To help us stay on your public airwaves. Oh, yeah. Thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer.
Yeah, I'm here too.
Okay. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter. You'll also find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.